Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. These are extraordinary times, certainly, and I'm wondering if we can even have a philosophical conversation about forgiveness and justice in times like these. We may never be able as individuals and maybe never as a society to forgive the people who destroyed so much on September 11th. Our first reaction after the shock was to ask who and why. We want to know who so we can go after them and why so we can understand their motivations. And it seems clear we intend to perhaps kill them. We're certainly going to attempt to bring justice to them at the earliest opportunity as a matter of self-preservation and our sense of justice. But it's also likely that anyone willing to be a suicide bomber is motivated by their own meaning of justice. They can't forgive us, so the only justice for them is to kill us. So maybe the matter of talking about forgiveness and justice is more than academic right now, because so much of what is happening in the real world is being shaped by how and by whom they are defined. We will talk a little bit about these concepts of forgiveness and justice during this hour. Our guest is Richard Feldman. He is from the Department of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. He is also the Friday Forum speaker today at the University YMCA. He will be talking at noon at the University Y at 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign on the campus of the University of Illinois. And that's free and open to the public if you would like to attend. We'll talk about a few of the ideas that he will address during that hour. Just to let you know a little bit more about Richard Feldman, this is a bit of a homecoming for him. He was campus minister at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana from 1961 to 1968. He's been a parish minister. He was professor and chair of the philosophy department and religious studies at the University of Wisconsin from 1971 to 1998. He was also acting chair of the Department of Art and Design, and we may ask you about that, as well as chair of the Wisconsin Humanities Council and a regular commentator on Wisconsin Public Radio for a few years. He's currently professor emeritus of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. As we talk with Richard Feldman, you are invited into the conversation. Your questions and thoughts are welcome on the topic. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. The numbers again around Champaign, 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Richard Feldman, good morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Well, I sort of alluded to the difficulty of talking about forgiveness and justice, but maybe we can, you know, sort of talk about the concepts, looking at it from a philosophical perspective and see where it goes. Mm-hmm. You gave me an advanced copy of your talk at the Y, and you make a direct connection. Maybe they're not two sides of the same coin, but maybe two elements of something larger. Forgiveness and justice are certainly connected.
Yes, they are. Let me say, first of all, that I am no authority on forgiveness. This all came about quite by accident. The local YMCA here had produced a series of Friday forums on compassion and conscience, and many months ago now, they simply asked if I would talk about forgiveness. Well, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a social scientist. I try to do philosophy. I've been retired now for some time and forgotten most of it. But other than that, so of course, what went through my head was to attempt to make some sense out of the notion of forgiveness. And the question that almost immediately popped into my mind was, well, what happens to justice when we forgive? And here by justice, I mean roughly the settling of accounts. We're all taught to say, at least those of us in the West, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. We don't really take that seriously. I mean, our economic system would collapse if we went around forgiving our debtors. So the question then, the central question before me became, does forgiveness, however it happens, preempt justice? And if it does, what sort of problems does that portend for us?
Well, maybe also the pursuit of justice plays into the process of granting forgiveness.
Yes, I think it probably does, looked at from one point of view, and I will, in the talk this noon, talk about the procedure in South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was the one quite recent. There have been other attempts, but the one quite recently and relatively successful attempt to as it were, buy amnesty at the price of truth and to grant forgiveness. And of course, one of the criticisms and one of the difficulties with that very process was by people who had been badly hurt over the years in South Africa, who said simply, but what about justice? What about the settling of accounts? And of course, the answer to that gets us into another aspect of the case. But that was the initial problem. What about justice for the individuals who have been hurt if forgiveness is granted to the evildoers?
I think the granting of forgiveness can be much more difficult in grave cases such as that of South Africa or the Holocaust and so forth. Mm-hmm. There, you know, I'm also, you know, reminded of incidents of, you know, road rage where people just simply – somebody cuts somebody off and they get – the person cut off gets so angry that, you know, there's this rage and they can't forgive the person for cutting them off. There's really – you know, in terms of justice, there's very little harm or inflicted in this case. And yet we still have a hard time just simply cutting each other some slack sometimes.
Oh, sure. And one of the classic discussions of forgiveness back in the 18th century suggested that there is a psychological dimension to forgiveness, of renouncing hate and rage, all of which are very destructive to the individual. But, you know, forgiveness comes up both in very serious kinds of situations, such as we're facing in our nation at the moment. It comes up in the less, the middle ground kinds of things, of road rage, to your example. But there has also been some trivialization of forgiveness. You know, we teach our children. We want to teach our children always to say, "I'm sorry." So brother hits sister, and you grab him by the scuff of the neck, and you say, "Now tell your sister you're sorry." And of course, he makes a face and says, "Oh, I'm sorry." And then, and then you turn to sister and say, "Now, do you forgive your brother?" And she, well, and we grew up with that. And occasionally, though only very, very occasionally, might I say or do something that meets with my wife's disapproval, and immediately I will say, "Oh, I'm sorry." And then I will look at her and inquire, "Am I forgiven?" And she will say, maybe reluctantly, "Yes," and then it's over. Yeah, of course. But so there's that kind of trivialization. But in these situations, the whole issue, both from the point of view of the victim and from the point of view of the person who does the hurt, is a much more serious issue.
Well, yeah. I mean, so we may know in our minds that we should forgive somebody, but in our hearts, it's very, very difficult.
Oh, are we capable? Are we psychological?
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to talk with more talented psychologists than I am. Yeah, it is. It is very difficult to renounce the very resentment that is eating us up. I don't know what to say about what I call this trivial ritual. Sometimes rituals aren't quite that trivial. Sometimes the only thing we can do is to go through the ritual of saying, I'm sorry. Now, is that going to help? Well, as you suggest, in our heart of hearts, the resentment may still be there, but maybe that's just the first step in trying to do something about it.
There's to use one of the more egregious examples of an injustice, you cite Simon Wiesenthal. He describing in his book The Sunflower, and I wonder if you could, you know, talk about that.
Sure.
And you know, he did a very interesting thing with the dilemma he was faced. Maybe you can describe that.
Yes, Simon Wiesenthal was a victim of the Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War, and spent a great deal of time and experienced firsthand the horror of it. On one occasion, and this is the story he tells in the book The Sunflower, he was working as a slave laborer in a military hospital, and he was quite arbitrarily simply grabbed by a nurse and taken to a room where there was a dying SS trooper. And it turns out that the SS trooper was wanting to confess to a Jew, any Jew, not a rabbi, not a priest, a Jew. This was a dying man. And he confessed to some really horrible crimes, one in particular of the SS driving a group of men, women, and children into a three-story building, setting it aflame, and then shooting those who tried to jump from the windows and escape. Well, he told Wiesenthal this story, among other things, and asked for his forgiveness. Well, Wiesenthal didn't know what to do. And he tells in the book that he simply turned in silence when he could and walked out of the room and said nothing. 30 years later, he wrote this story, and instead of just publishing it, it's a very interesting and unique book, he sent the manuscript to some scholars and intellectuals, among whom people like Jacques Maritain and Martin Marty, and Rabbi Jacob Kaplan, and others, and asked, what should he have done? And I'll talk about these answers at the Friday Forum in some detail, but the answers came in three forms. Some said, one in particular is very interesting. I think it was an Irish historian who said, I would have strangled him in his bed. Another said, you know, to be forgiving is to take to be the good guy. But what about the victims? Forgiveness is soft but very hard on the victims. Others said, one American Catholic said, oh, you must forgive because any withholding of forgiveness is itself a form of hatred. Others took a middle ground, and some said that Wiesenthal did the most decent thing possible by leaving and doing nothing. One American author said he should have said simply, I cannot respond to you. Well, now, all of that story brings up for me the question of whether we can forgive when the victims are other than ourselves. Mm-hmm. I can't stand at ground zero among the ghosts, however religious I may be, and grant forgiveness to those who have harmed others. That's the story.
Very interesting. Let me reintroduce our guest this morning. We're talking with Richard Feldman. He's a Emeritus Professor of Philosophy, University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, and he's the former campus minister here at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, back in the 60s, and he's got an amazing background, including, a doctor of philosophy in theology, he attended a divinity school, was a parish minister for some time. He's back here to speak at the University of YMCA Friday Forum lecture at noon today. That's free and open to the public if you would like to attend. Meanwhile, if you'd like to join our conversation, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I'm noting that in the current reaction to the terrorist attacks on September 11th, there seems to be a lot of angst amongst Americans. A lot of people feel that, first of all, I think everybody pretty much universally condemns the people who were responsible for the attacks. On the other hand, there seems to be a bit of a divide over our responsibility in many things the United States has done around the world, perhaps unjust things, things that caused the reaction on the part of the terrorists. And other people say, well, we shouldn't even be talking about that because that's not, you know, that's not patriotic, or, you know, maybe that's, you know, providing comfort to the enemy and that kind of thing. So I think that what we're grappling with is not just the injustice of the terrorist attacks, but you know, the injustice of the behavior of the United States in other parts of the world, and looking at each other saying, well, you know, you're not responding correctly to this.
Yeah, I have been deeply troubled by those responses. I think I said one point in my I will say one point in my lecture, far from being ready to forgive our enemies, we're having trouble forgiving ourselves. And maybe that's where we ought to start. I think one of the things that troubles me, and this is somewhat widespread among my academic friends, is that there is a tendency to make ideological and political hay for our own political points of view out of this. I think that's unfortunate. But you know, I would make I hope not too subtle philosophical distinction between the notion of cause and blame. Of course, there are causes for our being disliked or even hated. There are causes for anything. I take it that's a trivial truth. Our very existence is what we in philosophy like to call the difference between a necessary and sufficient condition. There are necessary conditions for this, hardly sufficient conditions. And I think that we need to take a rather balanced view about ourselves, about America. There is in the world a very sick anti-Americanism. I certainly would equally condemn an unthinking kind of patriotism. But on the other hand, whatever evils we have done, there is an image of America the generous, America the liberation, the liberators of Europe. I was at a meeting just last week in which a man of my age who had marched with Patton through Europe and helped to liberate the camps showed some pictures that he had taken, pictures we hadn't seen for years and were absolutely incredible. The America of the Marshall Plan, the America of Bosnia and Kosovo, the America of the Peace Corps, that we are a superpower that we have thrown around our weight is true. But you know, and this is probably a trivial analogy, but I would say to some of my friends, if you want to say to America, back off and don't be so pushy and don't be so, you say the same thing to your gay friends. Say, go back in the closet. There's some people who don't like you because you're too upfront about this. You know, be more. No, we don't. And we certainly don't say to our black friends, you know, there's some white people, you're too uppity. You should know your place. No, we don't. I think there has to be a balance of this, and some of what you talk about really does trouble me.
We have a couple of calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll go first to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if there's a difference between forgiveness and compassion. I mean, I guess forgiveness is not saying that something is okay, but it seems more that way than compassion, which may be trying to understand, you know, how one might have come to this position, which I would never justify, but that there are perhaps not direct causes and effects, but there are links. And, okay, that's my first question. Is there a difference between forgiveness and compassion?
Oh, there certainly is. And if our moderator here had asked me to define forgiveness, one of the first things I would have said was that there are a number of things that forgiveness is not. One of the things it is not is simply compassion. One can be understanding. One can be compassionate and yet fail to forgive. Forgiveness is also not forgetting. It is also not justifying. There's many things that is not difficult to define it what it is, but there certainly is a difference between compassion and forgiveness, and we certainly want to be. And I take it by compassion, you mean understanding, don't you? Is the listener still there?
Yes, I am. Well, it's sort of like seeing one's connection and understanding pain, but that doesn't justify producing other pain. And, you know, on the one hand, I mean, I could never see any logical connection completely between these actions and anything that's happened in the world, since I don't believe in that kind of violence as solving problems. Or, you know, I've heard people actually say, well, you know, we suffered here or there in Beirut or whatever, nobody understood our suffering, or in Palestine. And, well, that's true. That's probably true. We didn't understand. But to make people suffer to that extent in New York is not going to make people understand your suffering. So I think the logic is totally skewed in that sense. But I guess it's a very, in my mind, a very, it's a kind of understanding of your connectedness, and to see that when other people produce pain, it's often because they are feeling pain. As far as, I think that there are always two sides to our national image and our national, you know, politics and actions. But I think we can't perhaps emphasize one over the other, that we're all good, we're the liberators of the world, you know, we're the freedom fighters, and you know, that we are, you know, we are the symbol of freedom in the whole world, the beacon. I think we have to be informed. I think it's good that people are asking questions, but it's a very complex issue. It's not about justification to ask questions. Mm-hmm.
I think your insight that people who bring about pain are themselves feeling pain is very well taken. The trouble with this situation is it is such a unique situation that not only is it difficult to understand the motivations of the people who are doing this, but it is difficult to understand the situation as a whole. I mean, we understand political protests among people who want something. It's not clear that these people wanted anything except to hate us. Or if they wanted something, they may have wanted something that is not ours to give. So we're having difficulty reacting to a political situation which is so unique and so extraordinary that I think we don't quite ourselves know how to feel, but I certainly agree with your assessment, which is probably more psychologically astute than anything I had thought of, that those who cause pain do so on all kinds of levels because they themselves are feeling pain.
Right, and I'm not so much concerned about, you know, the logic of this incident, which seems to, you know, it's beyond my comprehension. I understand there are other discourses and there are, you know, political and religious that go into this, maybe psychological formations of certain individuals or whatever, or of a collective kind of whatever you want to call it, psychosis, I'm not sure what. But I'm really more concerned about, you know, the people in the Arab or Muslim world who may feel that they are attacked, being controlled. There may be a certain amount of paranoia. They have certain discourses and ways of taking in information, but yet there are circumstances like colonialism or, you know, kind of heavy-handed support of, you know, certain powers in the world over weaker peoples. So I'm really concerned about the direction that we take politically, and I think it's very important that people become more informed about the history of their government's policies. We can't change everything. And some of them we might not want to change, or we may say, well, what could we have done in Iraq? You know, we felt this person was attacking other people's rights to live, or we thought that the people would be capable of overthrowing this dictator, or we felt we shouldn't leave a power vacuum in Iraq, or we shouldn't, you know, take over a sovereign government, and our alliance would have fallen down. People wouldn't have supported that. Yes, get Saddam Hussein or Iraq out of Kuwait, but to take over that government would not perhaps have had worldwide support. So we can't always see the consequences of our actions, even though we've known, as Ramsey Clark has been pointing out, you know, the depth of the suffering, mm-hmm. and we've kind of forgotten about these change to smart sanctions as opposed to what we have been doing. But I think it's very important that people do become more informed, and if there's anything that's going to come out of this, that might be it. That's good.
You are very astute. I am worried about the logic of the situation or the lack of it, because we need to know how to respond.
Right.
I certainly don't want to see us beat up on other people, but I also don't want to see us beat up on ourselves. We don't deserve to be beaten up on, and we certainly ought not to beat up on other people needlessly.
No, it's not really beating up on ourselves. It's just like looking into yourself, whether as an individual or as a nation. I think we need to become more informed of how, you know, we've been sort of closeted in our little world. Now suddenly people are asking about meaning. On the other hand, there has been a lot of money on Wall Street that's been invested in socially responsible investing. I mean, it's not as if, you know, those people weren't involved in making a better world as well. So, but I think we have to not go either way in this kind of good-bad kind of dichotomy, but we do need to see things maybe we haven't been willing or able to see before. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much for your call.
Bye-bye.
Well, our lines are all full, and we're a little past our midway, so I want to go on and talk with some more callers, and let me just reintroduce our guest, Richard Feldman. He's Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. He's in Champaign-Urbana to give the University YMCA Friday Forum Lecture at noon today. So this is a kind of a preview of some of the things that he'll talk about there. That's free and open to the public if you'd like to attend. Meanwhile, let's go on to our next listener in Atlanta on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Thanks for the conversation. Taking the previous caller's premise a little step further, I think one of the mistakes that, you know, we are in the process of possibly making is that we have to remember that the government, we are the government, us people are the government, and there's been a tremendous outpouring of monies and et cetera to help the people of New York and to help the country in general, and I think that's fine. But I think the one thing that we must not forget, us being the government, is that we have to continue to support the organizations that do good works in this country. And everybody's got their own opinion what those organizations are, but that's what makes America America. And I think more than ever we need to support the entities that are America, the lobby groups, the, you know, whatever organization it is. And one example would be like support WILL, because without these conversations out there, we would, you know, we would all be worse off. And I think us as a government, that we cannot forget that we have to support the organizations in our life that are dear to us. And I'll kind of put that question to you two and see what you think.
It's hard to disagree with that, especially the WILL part, I'm sure. But thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. Yes, well, we'll get to our pledge drive a little bit later in October.
Okay.
But anyway, we've got a couple other callers waiting. We'll go next to someone in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I'm looking forward to your talk at noon, and at the risk of disappointing some listeners now, I'd like to change the subject just slightly to ask you to address concerns for individuals who are dealing with the issue of forgiveness for personal reasons. I have a number of friends who are victims of child abuse and who are struggling with the issue of forgiving those who have hurt them in the past. And it's my understanding that an aspect of forgiveness is so that you yourself can get on with your own life. It has to do with your ability to heal more so than any benefit you may give to the person receiving your forgiveness, that sometimes this can be done even without confronting the person or without the person having asked you for forgiveness. Could you take just a moment and address the issue of an individual forgiveness here beyond the scope of the September 11th issue, at least sometime before you disconnect today? Thank you, and I'll hang up and listen.
Sure. One of the things I want to say to the forum this noon is to remind them of something that Bishop Joseph Butler wrote in his famous sermons in 1726, a long time ago, directing our attention inward and arguing that forgiveness is simply the forswearing of resentment. That is, willing renunciation of feelings of anger or hatred in the one who has been wronged. And what Bishop Butler suggested is that what is transformed in the act of forgiving are the feelings of those who grant the forgiveness, and in so doing, as he would have put it, lift a burden from their own souls. But let me tell you another story that might be helpful, and that is a story that comes out of the correspondence between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, two great presidents. They had fallen into a very long-term political and personal disagreements. They lived together, they thought together, they fought together during the 1770s. But by the 1790s, they had become very very definite political enemies. What happened after that is very interesting and informative. By 1813, they had begun to come back together again, writing to each other, and the correspondence that went on then for years afterwards has been the source of a great deal of interest, both about these two men and about American history. But one of the most interesting things, on October 28, 1813, Jefferson wrote to John Adams in approximately these words. He said, "We are both too old and have lived too long to change our minds as a result of a lifetime of political thought and action. But even though we are both too old to change our opinions, we should not die before we have explained ourselves to each other." Those are very moving words. And from that intention to reconcile, to explain ourselves to each other, came what it seems to me is the essential element of forgiveness, a kind of restoration of a bond. And that comes about, I think, not simply by the ritual pronunciation of the word forgive, but exactly by explaining ourselves to each other. Let me say it this way, that experience for forgiveness in the long run is a conversation, and a conversation that may have to go on for years, both in terms of individual responses and perhaps in terms of our national trauma at the moment.
This is a very interesting point because, you know, we often fool ourselves into thinking, well, if there's somebody I don't like, I just simply won't deal with them and I don't have to share anything with them. On the other hand, we live in a closed system, this planet, and in a large sense, we all live together, and we have to have this long-term relationship whether we like it or not. And so this process or this dialogue seems to be perhaps the most important thing.
But the dialogue also presupposes, the dilemma is this: the dialogue produces restoration. On the other hand, to some extent, the dialogue requires restoration, and that's why forgiveness and justice are in such tension. Let me quote another story that I tell out of Shakespeare. Shakespeare has the murderous king in Act 3 of Hamlet praying for forgiveness. And in his prayer, the king asks the question, "May I be forgiven for my foul deed?" And one is supposed to think that the king, in the process of making his prayer, is reflecting on it. And he says, "No, I may not be forgiven, for I still have my ambition, my crown, and my king, or my queen. May I then be forgiven while I still have the fruits of my deeds? No." So here's the dilemma. the process of this dialogue, the process of communication, the process of forgiveness, of forgiving, produces restoration. On the other hand, it may very well be that this whole process requires some kind of pre-restoration. I'm sorry, yeah. That's not an easy thing to say, but there
yeah.
we are.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, we have just about maybe 15 minutes left, and we have a caller waiting. I've been making them wait. Don't want to wait too long. Welcome us into the conversation, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. Yeah, let me just say right up front so there's no misunderstanding that there's no justification for the atrocities that, have recently taken place. That said, though, I have to say I'm for somebody with your background, I'm a little astonished at the lack of intellectual rigor. And it seems to me just off the point analogies that you put forth of going back to the closet or not being uppity, they seem not only misplaced, but actually turned around as a way of silencing people who have been pointing out for a very long time that U.S. foreign policies, many of them, are not only anti-democratic and frustrating to the hopes and aspirations of many people around the world, but in many places have been used to actually cause a great deal of pain and death. And, at this point, I think it's very important that Americans need to understand, what's driving the animosity of so many people around the world. I mean, there are people rioting and demonstrating in Indonesia right now against the United States and other places. And it's not because they are opposed to democracy. It's not because they're opposed to freedom. It's because they're very mad that often they themselves are being denied that very thing.
All I can say is that you know a great deal more about this than I do. It seems to me that the situation is complex to the point of not knowing the motivations of people who are doing the very things that you talk about around the world. I think I'm going to let it rest there. I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a historian. Perhaps you ought to. I'm sure that WILL has had experts on these matters,
and will continue to do so.
Yes, yes. I'm sure you will.
Well, I you might want to review yesterday's program with a priest that was talking about shutting down the School of Americas and possibly Robert J. Lifton's program on Focus 580, among others. It seems to me, though, that you have some responsibility as an American to try to understand some of these things, just so that you can act responsibly in your own citizenship. And thank you.
Thanks for the call. Well, let me just pose this, because we're essentially having a philosophical conversation about forgiveness and justice. But obviously dealing with real world events, it's possible that the United States, it's been talked about that we may launch airstrikes in Afghanistan. Now whatever problems there are with that, among them are the fact that they may harm innocent people, and that is an injustice. And the people so harmed are going to be aggrieved. And will be, the direction I'm heading with this, it seems that there's a cycle of injustice and forgiveness or a lack of ability to forgive. And so that we end up contributing to the broadening of that circle.
Yeah. Justice itself, while it is a very good word, an honorific term, as we say in our language, is really a very difficult, almost terrible thing to contemplate, because justice has a long memory and an insatiable appetite. And one round of injustice leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And one of the questions you are raising is how is it possible to break into that cycle of justice and injustice and more injustice with something like forgiveness? I don't know if it is possible to break into that cycle. I think that we have to understand that we're dealing with human emotions that are not going to be easily managed. What would be wrong, it seems to me, with simply naked forgiveness is that without some attempt at settling issues, it's always true that then whatever evils and sufferings and burdens there are fall upon the victim. And that seems to me to be plainly unacceptable, unless we want to say, look, there's been a bombing and buildings have been destroyed and some people have died. That's too bad. The suffering has fallen on them. Let it fall where it lies. I have to respond to that in some way. And it seems to me that much of our culture, much of our moral culture, is set up as an attempt to, as it were, redistribute burdens. We make a distinction, and perhaps this is a simple philosophical distinction, between retributive justice and distributive justice. Distributive justice is the question of what is the proper distribution of the goods of this world. Retributive justice is the question, what is the proper distribution of the burdens and the sufferings of this world? Now, one of your listeners may not like this analogy either, but on a very simple level, we have an insurance system. Should we say, well, if my house burns down and it is insured, somehow the burden of my suffering, my loss, is going to be shared? It would be nice if we could simply back off from any response and issue a kind of blank check of forgiveness to any who do us harm. But Reinhold Niebuhr, a generation ago, in the context of a different war, pointed out that while it may be moral to turn the other cheek, we do not have a license to turn someone else's other cheek. And that's what haunts us. No one wants to increase the suffering. There's no point to that. No one wants to increase the injustice. There's no point to that. On the other hand, how do we say, well, too bad. The suffering has been done. Let's forget it now. That seems to me to be plainly unacceptable, too. And that's the dilemma. That's the hard place in which we all are at the moment.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that, but I will defer to callers. We have a couple listeners waiting. We'll go next to a listener in southeastern Illinois on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
My words fly up. My thoughts remain below. Words without thoughts never to heaven go. Recognize that? It's that scene.
I don't.
With same prayer scene with Claudius in Hamlet.
Oh, yes, yes.
I think that's an unusual play because the only person that's really likable in the whole thing is the villain. I don't care really for any of the others, but I mean, positively, I think they all sin, and Claudius is the only one who knows he's sinning. But
and there is some advantage to knowing when one has sinned, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah, yes. But yes. I'm wondering in this case, is this really a matter of forgiveness or hatred? I mean, perhaps I'm so far removed from the scene, and you don't from this distance on television, you don't get the stench and you don't get the really bad part of it. So that I don't feel hatred, but I don't feel any need for forgiveness either. I mean, it's simply a matter of a crime has been committed. I mean, do policemen have to either hate or forgive the people they go after when they're going after a criminal?
This is an interesting point, and if I may break in, there was we're running short on time, but I'll try to be quick. Really interesting letter to the editor in the News Gazette yesterday by a retired Green Beret who described his background as, you know, his training was not to hate the enemy. It was, you know, drilled into them, all emotion pertaining to an adversary is masked. Anger, fear, contempt, sadness get in the way of logic. And yet, he says, today I'm experiencing an emotion that has been foreign to me since I was a child. Hatred, pure, white-hot, unadulterated, flat-out hatred for the persons responsible for the acts, etc. And then he goes on to say, I'm almost sad for myself, for my thoughts. They are foreign to everything I was taught. I am not a bigot. However, I believe I could cold-bloodedly execute any of these perpetrators. And he goes on to say, I pray my God will also forgive me for my thoughts.
Well, that's interesting. I think my only reaction to that is to say about this letter that this fellow probably feels an intense frustration in the inability to understand the motivations. And just speaking for myself, however much injustice in the recent or long distant past, one cannot imagine human beings acting in this way, especially when there's no obvious thing that they want, nothing that we can give them, no reconciliation that is possible. Imagine that one of these fellows had survived the crime, and now we say we need to get on with this dialogue of reconciliation. How do we come back together? How do we understand what you have done? It seems to me wholly inadequate simply to say, well, it's because America has been this giant superpower, and somehow, and I hope nobody is really saying this, somehow deserves what's happening. It's an interesting letter.
Yeah.
Happy I don't have to respond to him personally, because it would be very difficult to do.
Well, we're all grappling with how to respond to a large number of things right now, and I unfortunately have to call a halt to the proceedings for the moment since we're here at the end of our time, and I apologize to one last caller we couldn't include in our conversation, but I will mention again that our guest, Richard Feldman, will be speaking at the University YMCA at noon today for the Friday Forum Lecture, and we'll speak more on the subject of forgiveness and justice, and that is free and open to the public if you would like to attend. Our guest again, Richard Feldman, Professor Emeritus from the Department of Philosophy at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.